We have a very special guest today. His name is J.D. Foster, Ph.D. He is a senior fellow in economics at the of policy at the Heritage Foundation, expert in Medicare, in Medicaid, Social Security benefits. He came to the Heritage Foundation in 2007 after serving in the White House, the executive branch, Capitol Hill, and private policy institutions. He's a regular on Bloomberg, Fox News, and Fox Business. Mr. Foster, thanks so much for being with us.
Well, thank you for having me on.
Tell me this right off the bat here. Tell me your thoughts on the debt ceiling committee, their failure. I mean, obviously, we all thought it was a bad idea to have the debt ceiling or have the that super committee. But tell us your thoughts on the failure and how it affects us as a country economically.
Well, Congress was set up to fail. The committee was set up to fail in this regard, and it did. Fortunately, the markets expected that, so there wasn't too much of an immediate hit. But we have a serious fiscal problem, essentially we're going to now take the next year and a half off from dealing with it. And the next president, whoever that is, and Congress are going to have to get busy very, very quickly getting our fiscal house in order because we are rapidly running out of time.
Do you think that, and it sounded like listening to you, did you think that this was a failure by design? And if so, why?
Well, there were... It's sort of a mixed bag, frankly. There were a lot of people who worked very hard to make it happen. The members of the committee took their work very seriously. But the Congress and the committee reflect a basic disagreement we have in the country as to the course the nation should take. Do we want big government high taxes, or do we want to get back government at least no bigger than it used to be? And that's the basic difference of opinion. And if you're going to have big government high taxes, then you need to have a huge tax increase, and that will be part of deficit reduction. The country is torn, and we have a Congress that predominantly believes in returning government to a smaller size and keeping taxes low. But we have members of Congress, particularly in the Senate and the President, who believe in big government and high taxes. We have a fundamental disagreement. The American people have created this situation in the last two elections, electing a far-left president and then a relatively far-right Congress. We need to get to the rubber match, which is the next election, to make a decision which course we're going to take, and then that president and Congress are going to have to make changes reflective of those electoral results.
Interesting. Should we, and let's just say we maintain a majority in the House, the Republicans do, and the Republicans get a majority in the Senate, should we be afraid at that point of reelecting Barack Obama?
Well, I don't want to comment on being afraid of Barack Obama, but he then is going to be in a very difficult position. And what we're talking about is degrees here, because as you laid out the question quite properly, the Republicans are not likely to have 60 or 61 or 62 seats in the Senate, even if they're outrageously successful. So the Democrats will have a voice, a strong voice in the Senate. And so it's a question of degrees. Under that scenario, you elect Barack Obama, we're going to have a result that has somewhat more taxes, but not as much as he would like, and deeper spending reductions. On the other hand, if we elect a Republican president, along with the Congress as you described, you're going to have even less tax increase and maybe none, and much smaller government. There are degrees in which we're going to have a resolution to this, degrees of tax increase, degrees of spending reduction. And the electoral outcome will tell you where you are on that spectrum.
Let me kind of take this down to the level of a regular guy. A regular guy's saving for retirement. Maybe he's 5 years away, maybe he's 10 years away, or she's 5 or 10 years away from retirement. How does the landscape look for Social Security and Medicare and economic conditions in general for their retirement?
Well, both of those programs, Social Security and Medicare, are driving us into the poorhouse. It's not the fault of current seniors or near seniors, but the simple reality is Congress has passed and presidents passed promised benefits that they didn't fund. And now we're dealing with that problem. It's no different than when GM promised the UAW benefits and didn't set the money aside, and it bankrupted General Motors. We're in the exact same position with regard to Medicare and Social Security. Those programs are going to have to be revised, and there's smart ways to do that, and there are harmful ways to do that. We'll have to see which way they go. This will in turn, in part, determine how the economy goes, because credit markets are looking at what we do to get our fiscal house in order. For anyone in retirement or near retirement, the number one issue has to be getting the economy back on track and a solid footing and growing rapidly. And all of our policy considerations should always have that in the forefront, because deficit reduction happens most effectively when the economy is growing strongly, that obviously is beneficial to portfolios as well. It will be reflected in stock prices. So the whole key to the exercise, both in terms of the economy in the near term and economy in the long run and fiscal policy, are pro-growth policies today. We got to pursue that today because that makes solving all of these other problems a lot easier.
You know, you're in a position to know, so I'd love to hear your answer to this question. In terms of smart fixes for Social Security and Medicare, obviously mathematically as they are today, they're going to implode. What is a smart way to fix programs like that?
Well, and fortunately, once you set the politics aside, we already know what most of these reforms would look like. In Social Security, it doesn't require that much drama. Now, you start to raise the eligibility age a little bit faster. With if people are going to live longer, they're going to have to work longer. It's simple logic. We're going to have to change some of the indexing formulas within Social Security. We over-index benefits. I'm sorry, but that's simple mathematical fact. If you do some of these relatively small things, you can get Social Security back on a sustainable footing. You do much the same with Medicare in terms of the eligibility age. But we can also do something else, which is complete the process that Medicare has been under for the last 20 years, which is moving it towards a system where the government helps seniors out, and then they go and buy their own insurance. That's what they do today with Medicare Advantage Part C. That's what they do with the drug benefit. It's sort of the natural evolution of Medicare. That's what Bill Clinton almost proposed, except
right.
The scandal got in the way.
Right.
It's what Paul Ryan proposed. It's what we at the Heritage Foundation proposed. It's a bipartisan proposal to do that. And once you do that, you start getting Medicare's expenses under control, and you change the economic dynamics in the healthcare system, the markets themselves, to help bring consumer pressures down and restrain the growth of healthcare costs.
It's interesting that you put it, if we would put politics aside, the fixes, as you pointed out, are obvious. At this point, we're in jeopardy of having our debt downgraded again. Do you think there's a time in the foreseeable future where we will put in these common sense fixes?
Yeah, I strongly believe that whoever is elected president, 2013, we're going to begin to take on these problems very seriously. The markets will have run out of patience, and at the same time, it is the most opportune time to do these things. And we've studied them enough, we've debated them enough, we know what they are. As long as the right and the left will give up their Christmas wish lists, you know, things like on the left, they think they've got to have tax increases on upper income taxpayers, on the wealthy, as political cover for the reforms to Social Security and Medicare that they acknowledge we need to do. Well, they've got to give up that dream in order to have a kind of package that can be bipartisan to get through the Congress. And on the right, unfortunately, Social Security personal retirement accounts at the moment just aren't in the cards. Not just because we don't have the political capacity to bring them about, but Social Security's own financing has changed so radically in the last 10 years that we've, at least for now, lost the opportunity to get personal accounts. If the left and right will give up their Christmas wish lists, we can depoliticize this to an extent and actually get something done. And I think that's what's going to happen in 2013. The election will decide what gets done, not whether something gets done.
We're talking today to J.D. Foster, a senior fellow at the Heritage Foundation. You were also a assistant director of economic policy for George W. Bush from 2002 to 2007. I'm curious your opinion on I'm changing gears here, but on TARP and then ultimately stimulus.
Well, let's start with the stimulus, meaning the fiscal stimulus. That was destined to fail. We said it would fail, and it failed just as miserably as we said it would. It was
right.
Based on the wrong theory. It was based on a classic Keynesian theory of government deficit spending creating aggregate demand. And it has always ignored one basic problem. Government doesn't create purchasing power in this way. Government has to borrow the money. When they borrow the money, it takes the money out of the private sector. It's like taking a dollar from the right pocket in your pants and putting it in the left pocket and pretending you have a new dollar. It doesn't work that way. The economy doesn't work that way. You might think of a conservation of purchasing power, analogous to conservation of energy in physics. You can't create purchasing power just by moving money around. So the stimulus was going to fail, and it did. TARP ultimately was abused terribly.
Right.
But at the time, when TARP was first announced, there's a psychological aspect to markets that is easy to forget, and that is sometimes markets convince themselves of something they need even if they don't really need it. And the markets had convinced themselves they needed the power of the federal government's balance sheet in order to assure there was a safety net under the whole federal, under the whole financial system. That's what TARP was intended to do, to assure them that there was that safety net. And so that aspect of TARP was probably proven inevitable because the markets insisted on it. But once it was there and the markets began to relax, then of course Treasury under Secretary Paulson began to do all sorts of things with the TARP funds, which was all that we were worried about them doing, misusing the funds. The forced bailout of the banks is a perfect example of that. So ultimately, it produced a lot of harm, but at the time, it was probably essential.
Were you for it at the time?
At that moment, yes, knowing all the bad things that might happen, but only because the markets themselves had insisted that that's what was necessary.
Gotcha.
It was all about the psychology of the marketplace, something that's not captured very well in textbooks. But when you see these events, and we're seeing it now in Europe, where the markets are convincing themselves that these countries are heading toward bankruptcy, that the euro is heading towards all sorts of difficulties, and the markets are gearing themselves up. The psychology of the market in the short run is something that you have to deal with as a policymaker.
Interesting. The euro is a whole different ball of wax. But I am curious. Many economists didn't believe that you could have one currency with multiple governments. Do you think the euro is destined to fail?
In its current form, absolutely.
Really?
I don't think it was necessarily destined to fail from the outset. It could have succeeded, but they didn't put in place the necessary political structures for it to succeed. Europe can have one currency if it wants to. I think once the current episode is over, you're going to have an entirely new euro, a different set of countries being participating in it, and it could very well succeed because it's going to have countries that are similarly alike and will follow the same rules, and it'll have the sufficient political underpinnings for the whole thing to work. That's what the German Chancellor Angela Merkel has been talking about of late, recreating the political structure to allow an economic and monetary union to flourish, built around Germany probably. You couldn't have countries like Greece and Italy and Spain part of this union without all of the other elements to the program working, political and economic. They got the monetary union in, and they hoped everything else would follow. They were explicit about that at the time. Now, everyone understands you're supposed to do this in a certain order, the political institutions first, the economic, and then the monetary. They reversed the order, hoping that they'd be able to sort of backfill the policies. But they didn't bother to backfill the policies. They didn't bother to create the institutions necessary for a monetary union to function, and they didn't bother to get the political institutions in place for a monetary union to function. And they were able to build up all sorts of problems as a result, and now we're seeing that in the peripheral countries.
I could talk to you about this all day, but we're coming up here on a hard break. We're talking today to J.D. Foster, Senior Fellow at the Heritage Foundation. Sir, if someone wants to find out more about the Heritage Foundation or about you personally, how would they do that?
Best way to do it is to just go to our website, which is heritage.org, and all of my TV appearances and writings are there under my name, J.D. Foster.
J.D. Foster. All right, we'll put a link up on our website. Sir, it's been an honor and a privilege to have you on our show today. You're a great American. Thanks for being with us.
Thanks, sir. Have a good day.
Thank you.
All right.